Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks episode. As per usual, we are going to dive right in. We've got something different today. Carly, will you read us your query letter?
We sure do. Here we go. Dear Carly, Cece, and Bianca, I'm seeking representation for my debut children's picture book, Hiccup. This 668-word book will appeal to readers who adore The Absurd Nature of Moose by Robert Munch, the dark humor of This Is Not My Hat by John Klassen, and the adorable brave owl in The Night Owl by Christopher Dennis. This story is an upbeat, interactive read that I believe will appeal to you due to its quirky characters, humorous ending, and potential to be paired with imaginative illustrations. Deep in the ocean lives a whale named Henry, who has hiccups for the very first time. Being a whale with hiccups isn't easy. Henry is overtaken by the intrusive and powerful hiccups that rise from his belly and shoot bubbles out of his blowhole, sending boats flying into the air. He searches the ocean for someone who can help him make the hiccups stop. Along his journey, he finds a few unsuspecting sea creatures who offer wisdom and advice. Henry tries every trick he can, hoping that something will work. Ultimately, Henry has to find a way to make the best of the hiccups, and thanks to the creativity of a slothy starfish, to see his situation from a new perspective. This children's book is inspired by my time living in the archipelago of Haida Gwaii. My Pacific Northwest-inspired stories have been published in Northward Magazine, aired on Smithers Community Radio, exhibited at the Robert Bateman Center, and screened at the Banff Mountain Film Festival. I have a degree in biology and psychology, but somehow found a day job in social impact. I've taken creative writing courses at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Education and tirelessly study the children's books I read to my son every night before bed. I live in Bragg Creek, Alberta with my husband, 2-year-old son, and golden mountain dog Rosa, who still misses her beach walks on Haida Gwaii. I'm seeking an agent that is a champion and a cheerleader as I roll up my sleeves and enter the world of publishing. I'm keen to work with an illustrator such as Vancouver-based Redacted. Please see the attached manuscript. Sincerely, Allison.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you so much. Will you give us the word count there and then your take on that?
All right, so word count, 369 words. So let's talk about the comps here. So first, actually, I should say, I really like the title. I will say that. I really like the title. Now, in terms of the comps, so John Classen's, all of his books really, are very morbid. And so you say here, like, the dark humor of This Is Not My Hat. Like, when you reference that book, I think you're probably trying to comp to the fact that that is his book about the ocean. So maybe that's what you're comping to. But his books are very, like, I don't know, morbid in a great way, which kid, like, I have this book and I read this to my kids and we always just kind of like smile at the end. So if you've read the books, you know what I'm talking about. Like, kids do love going to those dark places. And so, yeah, you said dark humor. I don't see in the query letter where the dark humor is coming into play, which makes me think it's not the dark humor that you're comping to. It's the fact that this is his book about the ocean. So that's something that I wanted to say there. Okay, now in terms of the body paragraph, so the body paragraph and the author bio paragraph are kind of the same size. And we usually bring this up because it's always interesting to us when there's just more focus on the author themselves than there is actually on the book. I understand with the picture book, there's not as much to kind of bake into the pitch itself. So, you know, I hear that, but let's just talk about what's happening in that actual paragraph. So it's definitely on the vague side, right? So it's like, along his journey, he finds a few unsuspecting sea creatures who offer wisdom and advice. Okay. And then I noted here again, like at the end here, it's like he has to find a way to make the best of the hiccups, but that's not what happens in a John Classen book. So that, again, that's why I'm thinking this isn't really about dark humor as much as it is, you know, focusing on the ocean itself. So yeah, I do think it's a little bit on the vague side. And this, I just think this is so interesting to critique on our show because we normally are focusing on longer novels and memoirs, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this is just a perfect example of how even no matter what genre you're writing in, no matter what category you're writing in, no matter what age group you're writing in, you guys are all kind of sliding into the same kind of safety net of, you know, not going deep, being like, you know, they're going to read the pages. So why does it matter that I really get into the specifics? But just for every single category, no matter what you're writing in, we're always going to want you to be as specific as possible, kind of like walking us up to that line of tension. Very, very important. Okay, so now the author bio paragraph. You said, you know, that it's inspired by your time living in the Pacific Northwest. So I'm just curious about, like, what specifically is inspired here? Is it the fact that, you know, you've done whale research or you saw these pack of whales, you know, swimming one time and this inspired you to write the story of this? Did you hear a story about a whale with hiccups? You know, I wasn't really sure, but like, what exactly was the inspiration other than the fact that you've lived in a place where you've witnessed whales, if that makes sense. So that's something to think about. I would cut the line about seeking an agent. I think that has to go. And those are really my notes. So did anybody else have any thoughts?
This is adorable. I'm sorry. I'm not going to be very useful today. To the author, I apologize. I always try to wear my critical hat. I do. I always try to poke holes and think about, you know, where you might be vulnerable, how to improve. But like the whole, the intrusive and powerful hiccups that rise from his belly and shoot bubbles out of his blowhole, sending boats flying into the air. This is so cute. Like, seriously, this is so cute. I love this. I love this whale. Yeah, it's adorable. I love it. I think it's the cutest thing ever.
Well, sometimes the wonderful positive feedback is super helpful too, even if it's just cheerleading. So there's that as well. Okay, Carly, will you tell us about the pages?
All right, so like the query letter promised, our wonderful little whale has the hiccups. And so we start off, I'm pronouncing it Henry. It is spelt the French way Henri. So I don't know if this author means for it to be Henri or Henry. So I'm saying Henry, but it is Henry with an I. So if I slip into Henri, I'm sorry about that. Okay, so Henry, he ate his lunch so fast, he gets the hiccups. So as we know, the hiccups are sending boats flying into the air and sailors are kind of flying everywhere. He sees some friends along the way explaining that he can't get rid of his hiccups. He meets an eel who's like starts a little wager with him about like if he can help himself with the hiccups, then, you know, he has to do something for him. We go back and forth in terms of trying to solve this problem. And then we get to the ending, which was kind of mentioned in the query letter, kind of cute ending where we meet a starfish. The starfish has an idea. The starfish wants a ride from the whale through the blowhole, kind of just having a little adventure, riding the bubbles far away. And then Henry looks over and notices a long line of starfish waiting for a ride on his hiccup blowhole adventure.
Awesome, Carly. Okay, what was your take on that?
Beginning, I was kind of thinking, like, maybe we need illustrator notes. And so if you're not familiar with illustrator notes, go to kidlit411.ca, where you'll be able to kind of get some more information on that. Because I was like, well, what did he eat for lunch? It just says he ate his lunch so fast, he got the hiccups, you know? So I'm like, sometimes these little notes to the illustrator in terms of like art direction can help us visualize it. But that was the only thing where I was like, I kind of wish I knew what he ate, because it seems like so important. I'm like, well, did he eat like a little fish, or did he eat like a submarine? You know what I mean? To me, that plays with like our interpretation of events. And so I think illustrator notes could have been useful there. But as I said, the rest of it, I didn't actually think needed illustrator notes. I loved when the like sailboats flew into the air. Really, really strong visual. Okay, now what I think would really elevate this quite a bit is the name. So you gave the whale a personified name, which is Henry/Henri, but you call everybody else by like a cutesy animal name. So it's like Jelly, who I assume like is a jellyfish, and Eel is just called Eel, which was really interesting to me because I think it's way cuter to give the animals human names. I read a lot of picture books to my kids, and I've also represented picture books and sold picture books in the past. And something that I think is really, really cute is to give real person names to the animals. Another example of books that do this really well are the Nothing's Wrong books, where they give the, you know, the bear and the rabbit people names, which I think is cute. So I would give the eel a person name. I would give the jellyfish a person name because Henry has a person name. So I just think that was a missed opportunity there to like really lean into that. I would definitely recommend that. So I also felt like there was a lot of examples of like when we were doing the obvious thing, which is Jelly says, oh no, I've had them before. Have you tried holding your breath? I'm like, that is the obvious thing. But like as a jellyfish, I'm assuming this jelly is jellyfish, but as a jellyfish, like wouldn't they deal with hiccups differently because they're a different creature with different body parts? So wouldn't it just be interesting if like, oh no, I've had them once before. Have you tried blank? And it's just something like wacky, but like that's normal in their world. This is the type of wacky thing that kids really like. So I just felt like that was a missed opportunity there. I also found a spelling error, which was wager was just spelled incorrectly. So I noted that for you to pay attention to. And I also want to talk about like the pace of the book, right? So I felt like the tension really leaked out of the story when the eel was trying to negotiate with the whale about like, you know, if I teach you to do this, you got to give me something, kind of this like sneaky, sly, like fox, you know, type of way. And then all of a sudden the eel says, you know, when Henry loses, he says, I'll give you a barrel of fish. And then eel says, don't worry, I'll let it slide, says eel as he slithered away, which I'm like, is that supposed to be like slide and slithered and all this like kind of movements? But then I'm like, why did he let the wager go away? I thought this would be like an Ursula moment where like, you know, there's going to be consequences to these actions. And also, you know, what's at stake if he doesn't solve the problem? What's at stake if he has the hiccups forever versus like, why does he need to solve his hiccups problem? So, you know, I think those are some question marks for me in terms of the story. The ending is super, super cute. I love this idea that the starfish are just like all, you know, sneaking up and being like, I want to go for a ride. So I do love that ending, but those are just some of my notes on the middle.
Thank you, Carly. Yeah, I'm thinking it's a really good thing that I don't have children that I have to read picture books to, because when you said, what did he eat that gave him the hiccups? My mind goes to Jonah. Jonah and the whale. That's what gave him the hiccups.
Kids actually would have loved that. Like, that would be funny to them, because that's what the John Clausen books are. It's like, they talk about animals eating each other all the time, but it's like not on the page. So I agree with you. I think it's funny to be wacky and absurd.
I don't think the biblical people would agree with me, though, if we did Jonah. So yeah. Okay, Cece, what are your thoughts there?
This is the best. I loved it. I thought it was so cute. Like the whole like hiccup thing. He has the hiccup and the hiccup won't go away. And then there's like hiccup. And anyone who has taken my classes knows that after like 2 hours of talking, I start having the hiccups, which is probably nature's way of telling me to shut up. So I get it. I get it, whale. I get it, Henry or Henri or however you pronounce your name. And it's just really cute. I love this. I see, this is why I can't work with picture books. I don't know how to critique them. I think they're really cute. Like, it's just adorable. I love it.
Awesome, Cece. Right. Thank you both for that. Right. We're going to go through to our second query, which we'll ask Cece to read for us.
Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, thank you for your helpful and generous advice about writing on T. Snaw Yaw. I love the podcast, and I'm grateful for all that you do. my literary novel, Redacted, complete at 83,000 words, interweaves the stories of a 32-year-old groundskeeper in 2001 and a 12-year-old girl in 1983 as they search Chicago for their missing loved ones. A cross between Namwali Sirpal's The Furrows, Tess Gunty's The Rabbit Hutch, and Rebecca Mackay's The Great Believer, Redacted is a story of mistaken identity and the longing for connection. In 2001, Jack, a reclusive groundskeeper for the Chicago Parks Department, has shut the door on his turbulent past as a foster care runaway. But when he meets Anna, a bright-eyed artist, she reminds him of his long-lost friend who once saved his life at the gritty makeshift camp for homeless kids. He is instantly enamored, hopeful at changing his solitary life, and invites Anna to move in with him. But as his attentiveness intensifies, Anna begins to retreat, and their relationship tilts off balance. When Anna suddenly disappears, the door to his past is flung open, threatening Jack's mental balance, and he embarks on a desperate quest to find her. Struggling to find footing as an adult, Anna has lived half her life preoccupied with a missed connection from her youth. If she'd been able to find out what happened to the missing child next door, things could have been different. The novel intertwines Anna's storyline in 1983 as a 12-year-old girl, aching to escape her parents' abusive marriage as she becomes infatuated with the new neighbor, a missing teenager who has mysteriously returned home after 5 years. But when the quiet, solitary boy is discovered to be an imposter, he disappears, and Anna enters the world of child runaways on a mission to find out who he really is and bring him home. Jack and Anna's parallel searches intersect in surprising ways, revealing secrets about the past and questioning whether they are pining after real person or the idea of one. A dual timeline narrative, Redacted is the story of Jack and Anna, both grappling with childhood traumas and finding imperfect answers to the questions of how to move forward and how to love someone. I won the Emerging Writer Award from Key West Literary Seminar for a different novel manuscript. My writing has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and appeared in Story Quarterly, Blackbird, Huffington Post Personal, Literary Mama, and elsewhere. I'm a Chicago-born writer living with my family in New England, where I work as a teaching artist. I've included the first 5 pages, which are part of the book's 15-page prologue. I wasn't sure if instead I should send the first 5 pages of chapter 1, which is Jack's 2001 storyline instead. Thank you so much for your help. Best, Redacted.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah, the fact that the author is questioning that makes me question the prologue. Dun, dun, dun. But we will get to that when we get to the pages. In the meantime, how long was that query letter and what was your take on it?
So this query letter came in at 477 words, and that includes everything, including the very first paragraph and the very last paragraph, which are clearly for the podcast, right? Our goal with our podcast is to offer educational resources to writers so that they can be well-equipped for success. And with that goal in mind, I am going to critique this as though you are sending it out to agents and not to the podcast, which is what we always do. I'm saying this because I don't think that you are framing the story in the right way if this were to go out to agents without any educational context, right? Like, remember, when you send this out to agents, it's the same as going on a job interview or going on the Shark Tank. Like, it's a business opportunity that you are offering to someone. You're saying, hey, do you want to invest in me? Like, it's an investment. And right now you're saying that we have two storylines, Anna's in 1983 and then Jack's in 2001. But the pages start with Jack in 2001, which we know from the query letter because you mentioned the little paragraph for the podcast, you know, saying that it's a prologue. And that would be too confusing for an agent. You know, for an agent to read a query letter thinking, okay, two timelines, one protagonist in one timeline, the other one in the other one, and then the protagonist that we were supposed to have in the present day goes to the past in the beginning of the pages. Like, that is way too confusing in my opinion. Remember that agents read things in batches. Remember that we get thousands of queries. So I do not think you're framing this right, in my opinion. We'll get to whether the prologue belongs or not when we talk about the pages. But yeah. So a few things about the query letter. First, thank you so much for the lovely paragraph about the podcast. We thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. I love the whole mistaken identity and longing for connection. Those are great, great themes. I do think that you have the advantage of, like, if this is literary fiction, then you don't need a bombastic conflict or a bombastic major dramatic question. But I still think you need one
that's a little more external than what you have now. Right now, it's framed as Jack and Anna's parallel searches intersect in surprising way, revealing secrets about the past and questioning whether they are pining after real person, I think there's a word missing there, or the idea of one, which is beautiful and introspective and very much in keeping with literary fiction if that's your jam. I just think that there could be a way to frame this with an external plot that would make it more propulsive. You still want literary fiction to have an external major dramatic question. I think that's really important. A question I have for you is this. Am I supposed to think Jack is creepy? Because there's a line that reads, as his attentiveness intensifies, Anna begins to retreat. And I read that and I was like, are we supposed to think he's creepy? Because I don't think we are. And I guess I'm just wondering about that. It's framed in a way that to me, I don't know, kind of made me think weird, strange. I don't know. I like the idea of two timelines and I like the idea of two characters. You are going to do it all in 83,000 words though, which is super impressive. So I wonder whether you have developed the character sufficiently. All in all, like I'm reading this query letter and I'm thinking to myself, this is a very ambitious story because it's very introspective, because clearly the stakes have to do with opening themselves up and finding out if they really love someone for real or if they love the idea of a person. And that is very internal. So it's a tall order and it's very ambitious. And I was excited to read more.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, what's your take on that?
All right. So just starting off at the top, you know, there's a lot of numbers happening just kind of visually in that opening paragraph. You know, obviously we have the word count, but then we have the 32-year-old, 2001, 12-year-old, 1983. I'm like, can we just say dual timeline, dual POV? I don't know. That's teensy bit tidier. And we can obviously get into a lot of the ages later on. So I don't know. That felt just like a lot of numbers kind of in my eyeballs. I think my main question was, number one, like friendship versus romantic, not super clear to me. I don't know if it has to be necessarily, like, but that was just something that definitely came up for me. I think my biggest note here overall, and this is something we talk about all the time when we talk about whenever there's more than one POV in a book, is people are going to gravitate towards one POV over another naturally. This is one of the reasons why dual POV or multi-POV is so hard, because agents and editors have to be equally invested across all storylines. And so when I see a pitch for dual POV, multi-POV, I have to know that I'm going to love all of these plot lines equally and be invested in them equally and be able to tell editors, like, you're going to love all of these equally. Do you know what I'm trying to say? In order so they kind of build together into the story. I felt personally, and we know this is a very personal business, I was feeling much more connected with the Anna paragraph than I was with the Jack paragraph, which, again, I'm just flagging that because other agents are really going to feel differently. Of course, this is just my opinion, but I just want to remind everybody of like how important it is just to make sure that you are just explosively pitching both of these POVs and how important it is for us to just know that like so much is happening equally in both of these. They're both very exciting. They're coming together in these exciting ways. They need each other. These plot lines can't exist without each other. That is what I look at when I look at a multi-POV story. And, you know, as we kind of alluded to, very important to include your pages the way that they show up in your story. And so, you know, obviously the author kind of noted here, you know, wasn't sure if I should send, you know, the first five pages of chapter one, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, you have to send us your prologue because that is how your book opens. So those are my notes.
Thank you, Carly. Just on something Carly said now about how this is such a personal business. For all of our listeners who rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. I get a weekly update with those reviews because I like to read them, because we like to hear from you and see if there's things that we can be doing better. And we got a lovely 5-star review recently, but that also gave the critique that we will contradict ourselves. And sometimes we will say one thing works, but the next time we'll say that same thing doesn't work, etc. And the person was a bit frustrated by this. And I understand their frustration, but here is the thing. Every book is different. Every writer's strengths are different. Every story is different. What works in one instance will not work in another. Most times we say, don't do a prologue. And then every now and again, you'll hear us say, the story needs a prologue. So our aim is not to confuse you, but to also make you understand how subjective this will be for other agents and for editors who might like different things at different times in different genres written by different writers. You know, there's some pet peeves I have when it comes to books where I'm like, this is too much telling. I can't handle it. Why is there so much telling? And then I'll pick up Hello Beautiful by Ann Napolitano, and that book is 80% telling. And I'm like, this is exquisite. So, you know, it is very subjective, and the rules keep shifting. It's like walking on quicksand or juggling with jello, people. Clear as mud. Okay, right. We're going to go to CC.
Just to echo what you said, if you can handle the subjectivity coming from the podcast, then that means you can handle the subjectivity coming from the business. So think of it as like boot camp. We're preparing you for this. We wish it could be more objective because it would probably make all our jobs easier, but that's just not the magic of books. All right. So summary. It's 1983. We're in Jack's point of view. He arrives at the city of runways and we get interiority hinting at what finally made him leave, right? Back when he was at his foster home. As he's making his way past the entrance, a voice calls out to him and he's deciding whether to bolt or to hide. And a girl, and the voice is not coming from the girl, a girl yanks him down. And she tells him all the stuff about the place, right? Like all the rules, what to do, what not to do. She basically gives him the rundown of everything. He wonders about her story, but he knows better than to ask because she has mentioned don't ask. And she says that his name's going to be Crow because he looks like a scarecrow and no one there goes by their real name for safety purposes. So that is what happens.
Awesome, Cece. I have some thoughts on the opening pages, but I'd love to hear yours first.
I want to first say that clearly this was a very carefully constructed scene. I think, it's just my opinion, but I think that I'm good at telling when someone was very careful about building scene work. And I can tell this person was very careful. There's a lot of clarity. There's no confusion about who's talking or what's happening or the movement. And so this is very intentional and I appreciate that so much. And I do want to give a shout out to the author for that clarity because that is a skill and it's a very important skill. I personally think... So I'll start with big picture notes and then I'll zoom in. Big picture notes is you're starting in the wrong place. Like the whole prologue thing about Jack 1983, scrap that. If this is a dual timeline novel and we get Jack in 2001 and Anna in 1983, then keep it at that. I understand the temptation of being like, let me just show you Jack's origin story. Keep that as a bonus chapter. When your novel is very successful, you can release a bonus chapter. You can put it on your website. I don't know. We can talk about that later. But truly, we do not need this prologue. We just don't. It's confusing to shift between different timelines in that way. If we only get Jack in the present for the rest of the book, do not give us Jack in the past in the prologue. Not when there's already someone else in the past. You know, it's just too much for our poor brains. So I don't think we need it. I will also say, in addition to the timeline issue, I don't think that this is the right place to start because it's setting up the past in a way that is leaking the tension. Let me now zoom in and explain what I mean. So the girl yanks him and we know, so there's a voice, a man's voice calling out to him as he's entering the city and he is scared. And then someone else yanks him. We know that someone else is a girl before we know that she's yanking. That's just how the sentence is written. And that's a missed opportunity for tension. In about a year, everyone's going to see Bianca's new book. And there is a scene right in the beginning where the protagonist is yanked by someone. And that's written in a way that we don't know who's yanking her. And when we find out, it's at a different moment. And because of the order of things, first the yanking, then finding out who yanked her, the tension bursts in a good way. The tension builds. That's what I'm trying to say. Because we get scared. Oh my gosh, who's yanking this poor boy in this runaway city? And then we find out it's a girl and it's a girl his age and he's safe. But because of the way you've written things, I know right away that it's a girl his age and that he's not scared at all because there's actually a line that reads he's not scared. And so you're leaking the tension there. Another thing is he's talking to this girl and this girl is just giving him the lay of the land, unprompted. She's trusting him. He's trusting her. I don't buy it. You have two runaway kids, right? Like I'm fine with the fact that she's going to tell him the lay of the land, but in his interiority, we need to see his skepticism. We need to see his distrust. We need to see him be uncertain. We need to see him making more associations, theorizing more. The way it's framed, it's just too easy. He's just like, okay, like he basically believes her, or at least there's no indication that he doesn't. Whenever she's saying things about him, saying things like he's tall, we get no interiority on, oh my gosh, this has been like his problem all his life. People think he's older than he is because of his height, or maybe something else. Maybe thank goodness for his height. I don't know. But there isn't any interiority giving me socio-emotional framework of his character, which is the purpose, the main purpose of interiority, really. And so when it comes to how skeptical he is, I think that needs to be adjusted. And I also think that, yeah, just generally, I wouldn't start here. You asked if you should include the first chapter or the prologue. And I think you did the right thing including the prologue because I want to read the true beginning of a book. But I don't think that this is your beginning. My two cents is we need to start with chapter one, most likely.
Awesome, Cece. Thank you. Carly?
All right. So I felt very like intense about this scene just because it is very emotional for me to be like, this child is alone and then, you know, seeking out this camp. I don't know. Like, I felt very emotional towards these pages because it's just a very emotional situation. I had like a pit in my stomach for him. And yeah, I don't know. I was like very swept away by emotion. But in terms of my notes here, the biggest thing for me was that he, like, as a child, a 15-year-old as a child, he would be seeking comfort. And he probably had this like hardened edge to him, right? Based on his upbringing, but he was seeking comfort. And so he's going to this shelter, you know, situation, seeking a new home, basically. But the fact that he was just so easily able to feel like, you know, he trusted her and everything that she said was the truth. And I never got the sense that he was really questioning, you know, is this some sort of like survivor thing where it's like, you know, you got to get your loyalties together and then there's this side and that side. And I just didn't feel like there was a lot of questioning the trust and like, why is she helping him and all of that. And maybe it was just optimism, right? That he's like, okay, somebody's finally looking out for me and somebody wants to help me. You know, I felt that. But then we moved into the part about the intricate system of the hierarchy of the camp and distinct territory lines where you could cross and couldn't cross depending on how long you've been. That's a lot of information dump in terms of like, that's information we don't need at this point. You know how we got to experience that is that she has to take him on a walk and they accidentally cross a line and then the other side comes for him, right? Like that's an example how we would bring that to life on the page as opposed to telling us there are distinct territory lines. That's the difference. So it was a very emotional read. And in the end, you know, I just like, it's like, you know, we'll call you Crow, she decided. Nobody went by their real names at the camp. And I felt like we were getting there and there was a real sense of atmosphere here. And I really felt for the characters. I just don't think we were going about it the right way just based on those notes I shared.
Thank you, Carly. Yeah, for the author, you know, this was incredibly well written. You're a really good writer. I just, for future scenes, even if you take this out, err on the side of a bit more showing up front and a bit less telling an exposition. It's almost like you're giving a stage direction because you want the reader to imagine every little thing up front and then you go to the characters. And sometimes it's really good to put a reader in a space where you're like, what? This child's in a camp. There's people sleeping on the ground. There's fires. Like, this is weird. What's happening? And so they keep reading to find out the context of why this child is in this situation, as opposed to you opening up, telling us the whole situation, and then getting us to that part. So always look at the exposition you've given us, say, how long can I withhold this? Can I put it in, intersperse it in between the action in tiny little beats so that the reader has a question in their mind and then keeps reading to find out what's happening rather than being told everything up front. So that's just my advice to you going forward with the rest of your scenes, if they are also constructed in the same way, but otherwise, excellent, excellent writing. Right, Carly and Cece, thank you so, so much. Let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. It's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
I'm Chelsea Devantes, and I wrote a comedy gal memoir. It is titled I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, but I'm going to anyway. And it is out on June 4th. I have partnered with the indie bookstore, The Purple Couch Bookshop, who I recently met, and I just love them so much. And I've also partnered with the podcast, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing, to give away 15 personalized copies of my memoir to listeners who enter the giveaway. And here's the thing. I always wanted to know about jobs, about writing, how people got into entertainment. And so when I wrote my memoir, I included all those details. I listened to podcasts like The Shit No One Tells You About Writing all the time when I was coming up, trying to learn, glean, get details, get the dirt, get the goss. I included all of the goss. It is my life. It has wild twists and turns. Listen, I date a magician. I find out my dad is not my dad. I go on to become Jon Stewart's head writer. There's all kinds of things in there, and I put a lot of deeds in. So I'm looking forward to being a speaker at the All About Memoir webinar on the 11th of May, where I will be talking more about the book and more about how to memoir, because I read memoirs all the time. I host a podcast called Glamorous Trash, where all we do is cover memoirs, specifically female celebrity memoirs. So enter the giveaway to win a copy of my book, and I will see you at the workshop.
Today's guest is a writer and editor from Memphis, Tennessee, with a BA in English from Whittier College. As a writer, she strives to explore the nuances of unlikable female characters and humanize Black women by giving them space on the page to breathe. While We Were Burning is her debut novel. It's my pleasure to welcome Sarah Coffey. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's wonderful to have you here. Right, so for our listeners, I'm just going to read you the jacket copy just so that you know what the book is about. Parasite meets Such a Fun Age in a scorching debut that is as heartbreaking as it is thrilling, examining the intersection of race, class, and female friendship and the devastating consequences of everyday actions. After her best friend's mysterious death, Elizabeth Smith's picture-perfect life in the Memphis suburbs has spiraled out of control, so much so that she hires a personal assistant to keep her on track. Composed and elegant, Brianna slides so neatly into Elizabeth's life and proves herself indispensable. Soon the assistant Elizabeth hired to distract her from her obsession with her best friend's death is the same person working with her to uncover the truth behind it. Because Brianna has questions too. She wants to know why the police killed her young Black son, why someone in Elizabeth's neighborhood called the cops on him that day, who took the first step that stole her child away from her. And the only way she's ever going to be able to find out is to entwine herself deep in Elizabeth's life where the answers to her questions lie. As the two women hurtle towards an electrifying final showdown and the lines between employer and friend blur, it becomes clear that neither of them is what they first appear. Dun, dun, dun. Right. So, Elizabeth, I always say on the podcast that I write from a place of supreme rage and also often hopelessness. And I know by reading the letter to the reader in your book that you do as well. So could you read us that letter and just discuss the inspiration for this novel?
Dear reader, this book was born out of hopeless grief and a desperate longing for justice. During the summer of 2020, I felt like I was surrounded by stories of people who were wrongly killed, people who had their voices taken from them without a say in their future or even in their innocence. I was so sick with grief for the state of our country, for the state of the world, that I felt like if I held it all in, I was going to become someone entirely different. Someone with rougher edges, someone with a closed-off heart. It was in this darkness that I found the pages of While We Were Burning. I wrote this book while reflecting on all the feelings that had been dwelling inside me, not just from the summer of 2020, but for my entire life. As someone who'd grown up in Memphis, Tennessee, with grandparents who told me stories about Jim Crow, there was a yearning to tilt the world, to change things for the better. I consider this book to be a love letter to my hometown and its commitment to seeking justice, particularly since it has served as the bedrock of several civil rights activists throughout history. I also chose to set this book in Memphis because it felt like the perfect backdrop to explore issues like class and race, especially the problematic underpinnings of privileged communities and their ability to harm the underprivileged, whether they realize it or not. However, it's also a story about hope and the possibility of connection, of wondering what things could be like if we were more careful with one another and if we took into consideration what we truly owe one another to. With that, dear reader, I hope While We Were Burning resonates with you and that it serves as a reminder that we don't have to accept hopeless situations because we can always try to make things right, even if things get a little messy. With hope for a better world, Sarah Coffey.
Wonderful, Sarah. Thank you so much. It's interesting that you included in the author note why you set the book in Memphis. You know, to me, it seemed like in a very organic, natural setting, especially since that's where you're from. And certainly this is a story that could play out in pretty much any town in the US. So it made sense to me that as the author, you would work with, you know, what you know. Was there a reason specifically why you felt that you had to kind of explain that?
Yeah. So the reason is I feel like a lot of, you know, big domestic thrillers happen in the, you know, bigger cities, right? Like LA or New York or Chicago. And I was just like, I'm going to set this in a medium sized city. And I feel like I might need to explain that because like, oh, why is this, you know, serious kind of like big thing happening in Memphis? It's like, well, this can happen anywhere. So that was my feeling behind it.
Yeah. And I love that. And for our listeners, this is something that comes up all the time. You know, people are like, but I don't live in New York. I don't live in Chicago. So how am I supposed to base my stories there? I live in this medium-sized town somewhere else. And this book came alive on the page, you know, for many reasons, but one is because of its awesome, awesome setting. I've never been to Memphis. This book made me like go, I need to go to Memphis. So this is what's incredible about setting the book in a place that you know that is not New York and that is not a big city that everybody knows, especially since this is the kind of story that can take place anywhere. So don't always feel like you need to set the books in these big places. Read this book and you will see why a city like Memphis just worked so, so incredibly well for this. Now, Sarah, I have a pet peeve as a writer when it comes to publishing. And I've mentioned this many times on the podcast before. It's not just when it comes to your book, is that we as writers work so hard to build a story up slowly, to plant curiosity seeds, to create intrigue and make the reader go, ooh, what's happening here? What's going on? And then I don't know why publishers do this, but they put everything on the jacket copy. They just put it all there. So I've gotten to the point where I don't even want to read jacket copy because I feel like it gives too much away. Now, on the jacket copy, it says that Brianna's son is killed by the police. But in the actual novel, I don't even think this is something you reveal to us until like page 100. You know, we come into it seeing Brianna at the funeral. We see her pain. We know that she's lost someone really important to her. But the characters kind of talk around it. Her and her husband or her partner, her longtime partner, they talk around it. And you only reveal it later. For me, it's always interesting, especially when we debut authors, because I kind of feel like I'm at the point now in my career where if my publisher did this, I would push back and be like, you're taking something that is a reveal and you're putting it right there on the jacket copy. Like, there's a reason I wrote it this way. Can we change the jacket copy? But I feel like with debut writers, we're so grateful to be published and we're so, oh my God, this person wants to publish my book. So I don't feel like I can push back against this. And I don't think it's going to ruin it for the readers, but I just feel like if we are going to be so intentional about how we build up a story, I think it would be great for publishers to kind of be intentional about the way they reveal this information, you know, on the jacket copy as well, so that it doesn't misalign with what it is that we're trying to do. Right. So writing dual POV and dual timelines for a debut is incredibly difficult and it's very ambitious because, you know, we've said before, and regular novel is 80,000 words. And if you have just one character, they get to spend 80,000 words with that character and you get to build the world. The minute you have two POV characters, you only spend like 40,000 words with each of them. But with this kind of book, you actually spend more because they're interacting with each other the whole time. You get each of their POVs, but you get to see each other through each other's eyes. Now, you wrote the one character in the third person POV and the other one in the first person POV. Can you explain to us how you approached setting up these characters from when you started writing the book? How you decided who should be first person, who should be third person, and how you find your way into their voices?
Yeah, so far, Elizabeth's POV. I often tell people that Elizabeth thinks she's the main character, right? So, of course, it's first person POV. She's like, this is my story. No one else matters, you know? And for Brianna, it's close third because she's already more self-aware of like the world around her. And I think that plays into first third, like, a lot, close third a lot better. So that was my thinking behind the POV choices for the characters. It wasn't too much deeper than that. Yeah.
There's something to be said for like a kind of narcissistic character. If you put them in the first person, you get this claustrophobic sense of their narcissism almost, whereas they aren't even really aware of it. And Elizabeth is such an interesting character because she thinks she's super woke. She thinks she's very like political and that she's very liberal, etc. But there's a lot of things that she's not aware of, which you can explore so much better in the first person because she can only tell us what she's aware of in terms of herself. And then when it comes to Brianna, we really get another view of her completely. So can you speak a bit about setting Elizabeth up in terms of these nuances that you did so well? You know, this very supposed outward wokeness and even interiority, she's sort of very liberal, but there's so many things that she's just completely unaware of.
Yeah. So Elizabeth is just meant to be written as like delusional as possible. That was my thinking behind Elizabeth. Kind of a walking contradiction of a person. So, you know, saying one thing outwardly, thinking another. Very important that she just kind of lacked self-awareness. But yeah, but basically the inspiration for the character was this clip that went viral back in the summer of 2020, where you had this white woman who came up to a black man who I believe he'd spray painted BLM on like his sidewalk. And she was like, oh, I don't think the owner of the house would like that very much. And he was like, oh, you know the owner? And she's like, yes, I do. He wouldn't like that very much. And of course he said, well, I'm the owner of this house. Like, you know, and then he was like, so, you know, so you're racist. And then she was like, no, I'm not racist. And it was interesting because people online, you know, looked into her and found out that like, yeah, historically she'd voted correctly. She was very like liberal in her beliefs and everything. And yet here she was doing this very racist thing on camera, right? So that was kind of where I got the idea of Elizabeth's character up. This is someone who is doing all the right things, but then like is just being racist right now and does not seem to realize there's a disconnect between her actions and the way she's living her life. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that in the book because it really, you know, in the beginning, we approach Elizabeth in a certain way. And as the story unfolds, we start to go, oh, interesting. Originally, we only saw her as she saw herself. But later with Brianna, we're going, okay, she is different. And it makes us as the readers have to reevaluate how we originally came on board with this character. And that makes for much more active reading. We've got to keep stopping and going, is this the character the way I originally thought they were? How much heavy lifting do I have to do as a reader to sit with how uncomfortable I feel about certain things she's doing compared to how Brianna is perceiving them? And can you talk about that kind of nuance when it comes to writing a character? Because especially for a debut author, you could have put it right up front that she was kind of problematic, etc. But you let her unfold in a certain way, you let her percolate, and then you kind of hit us with a different view of her, which I absolutely love.
Yeah. So I just love unreliable narrators. That's like one of my favorite like viewpoints, POVs in fiction. I just love it. And it's like combining someone who's, like I said, you know, delusional, has no self-awareness with that like kind of trope in fiction, which is a lot of fun for me to explore. And as well as for writing the nuance of that, my thinking with the character was just basically Elizabeth and Brianna are opposites when it comes to like their POV as well, right? So whatever Brianna would think, Elizabeth thinks the opposite, whatever Brianna would do, you know, something kind or thoughtful, perhaps Elizabeth would not consider it, right? That's kind of like how I went into writing the nuances of these different characters for that.
Yeah, and there's so much social commentary in this book. There was a lot, but it didn't feel heavy-handed. It didn't feel like we were reading it. We were being hit over the head with this social commentary. It was almost like the background to the story, because what's at the forefront is the plot of Elizabeth's friend dying, of Patricia dying and her becoming sort of obsessed with that. So that is the forefront. What Brianna is going through almost is the backdrop to her motivations, but it doesn't feel like it's right at the forefront of the book. Can you talk a bit as well about writing from a place of rage, coming to something with this hopelessness and despair, but not leading with that, almost going, okay, that is going to be my character's motivation. It's the character's sort of backstory and what propels them, but I am leading with a plot in this particular way.
So I'd say that actually goes to the title of the book, you know, While We Were Burning. I was thinking of that while writing, because the idea is that, you know, Elizabeth is living in her own world, right? Most of her problems are ones she caused herself, to be honest. Just kind of like not really aware of things. And you have Brianna, you know, who's going through all this grief and all this like distress. And, you know, I think at one point I describe her grief as feeling like she's on fire, right? It's just an awful time. And just the contrast of those is interesting to me. Also, it's, I guess, a personal writing thing for mine, where I think it's important to kind of remember that we're leading with like entertainment, right? For fiction writers, especially genre writers. So like entertainment first, you know, and then message kind of after that. Also, like you said, I don't think anybody wants to read a book where like it's all message. It's just like, you know, they don't really want to engage with it. I also think it's better if people get like entertainment first, because then they get attached to the characters and feel more of an emotional resonance with them, which I think is really important for Brianna's character as well. So I think it's important to entertain first and then like get the message in there, like sneak it in a little bit versus the other way around. Yeah.
Yeah. And Brianna was a lovely, lovely character. You know, there was just so much heartbreak happening there, but also so focused, so kind of fueled. I don't want to give a lot away in terms of the plot. You know, I don't want to be the jacket copy person who's giving away too much, but we immediately meet her at a time where she is going through so much and there's just so much emotion. There's just so much that's overwhelming her. And then we find her gain this purpose and we see her focus. Now, you've said that you like to write the so-called unlikable female characters. Can you speak a bit about, you know, writing a character who in certain instances seems unlikable, but you still give the reader enough to connect with in terms of their vulnerability? Because even Elizabeth, you know, there were times that I really liked Elizabeth. And there were times when I was like, oh man, Elizabeth, come on, catch a wake up, you know? And it was interesting for me as the reader to be on her side, not be on her side, be on her side, not be on her side. With Brianna in the beginning, I was like totally on her side. Later, there were things that she was doing and I was like, ooh, biting my nails, etc. But, you know, I love that we are seeing so-called unlikable female characters, because there's so much pressure put on female characters to be nice and sweet and kind and likable. And this doesn't make for very interesting reading, let's be honest. So for our listeners who are trying to write these kinds of characters, what is your advice to them?
Yeah. My advice to writers when it comes to unlikable female characters is just to remember that, you know, people are nuanced. Like, my advice is often just like, you know, write them as people, right? That's the whole advice. Like, to kind of get at what you were saying, there is unfortunately an expectation that women in fiction are likable, or, you know, are just warm, or this default, quote unquote, normal. Not a lot of emotion there, especially negative emotion. And then so writing against that, it's really just writing a fully realized person. So that's kind of my advice. Do not be afraid to explore, you know, like rage or like grief or more extreme emotions, especially the ones that people are uncomfortable with, particularly those, you know. I think that's where you get the interesting gems for characters.
Yeah. And we've said before on the podcast, when we review query letters and critiques, that's so difficult to begin with grief, because grief is a process that can be very static. It can be very debilitating. It can be too quiet on the page, but you took grief and you used that as Brianna's impetus. Like, this is what fuels her. This is what drives her. And that's something really interesting for our readers to consider as well. So for those of you who want to begin with an inciting incident, because for Brianna, her child dying is the inciting incident to everything that happens. We don't know until page 100 that that is what's happened in terms of that becoming fully clear, but we know this terrible thing has happened, and her trying to find answers and her grappling with it is what is propelling her story forward, her plot forward. So again, any advice you have, Sarah, for people who begin with grief, who begin with this overpowering emotion, but being able to use that in a propulsive way?
Yeah, I feel like I'm just going to summarize what you just said, but that's basically what I did, right? Just using an exciting incident, but then keeping that air of mystery, right? About that was the idea, to keep that a mystery, to see like, well, what exactly is she grieving? What is going on here? To keep the reader interested by not giving them all the information up front. Because I do agree, it is hard to start a book off in a place of grief and keep that going. As you said, grief is very static. You know, it's just not necessarily interesting to the reader. So doing other things too, like, you know, a dual POV, for example, so you can move around characters helps, or just chopping it up with other things going on will help a lot. So people don't just feel like, oh, this person's been sad for like 6 chapters, you know?
Yeah. And remember, for our listeners, I will say something like, you know, grief's not all that interesting. And then we'll have another book like someday, maybe, that was all about grief. The whole thing was about grief. And that was an extremely propulsive read. So, you know, we say generally, try not to do it because we see people make mistakes here. But then we have books like Sarah's and we have books like Someday Maybe that completely blow that rule to smithereens. Sarah, our listeners love hearing about journey to publication for debut authors. Can you speak a bit about how long it took you to write the book, how long it took you to find an agent, how long it took you to sell the book?
Yeah, it is a long and winding journey. Okay, maybe I'm trying to think when I first started actually writing full-length novels. Because before this, I was writing poetry, and then I moved into writing screenplays, and I moved into writing full-length novels. I think my first full-length novel was maybe 2015, 2016, around there. And it was actually a romance, to people's surprise. So the first genre I worked in was romance writing, and then that didn't go well because of my tendency to write female characters who are unlikable. That was a note I got quite a bit, was like, we don't get why she's so like snappy. She has an attitude. If we have this male lead who's very cocky and arrogant, she always has a response for him. And that's going to turn off readers, right?
I personally love that kind of protagonist, even in romance. But anyway, yeah.
So getting that note a bunch eventually inspired me to, you know, turn toward a different genre, basically. So I was like, okay, so people, they're not liking what I'm putting down. I'm going to look at writing thrillers. I mean, I was actually inspired to do so after seeing that Paula Hawkins was previously a romance writer who turned to writing thrillers. And I was like, okay, maybe that shift will also work for me based on the characters and the feedback I'm getting. So here we have, you know, I started writing thrillers. The first one I started working on did not get very far, basically. I think the feedback was like, well, there's not enough happening soon enough, was a good consensus of the feedback there. It's like, it's interesting, but, you know, we don't get a big twist until like the last 2 chapters, right? And we don't want to deal with that. But that book was actually enough to get me interest from an agent. So that's how I got my agent from interest for that book. And then after that, I did something very unwise. I started drafting and, you know, finished writing While We Were Burning, the first draft of it, without telling my agent I was working on that book. I didn't tell her anything I was working on. I just wrote a draft of this book and sent it. And she was like, yeah, so authors usually tell me when they're working on something and you've written it to completion. And she was like, yeah, you're supposed to just like give me like a summary and I can say yes or no. Like, don't ever do this again. Right. So thankfully she liked it, but she was like, tell me when you're working on something next time. So yeah. And then we worked on revising that book for like a full year, just back and forth notes, because yeah, it is very hard to do a dual POV. I believe at one point Brianna wasn't even close third. I think she was like, you know, eye of God kind of POV. And then my agent was like, no. So they had to rewrite the POVs, a lot of scenes over and over and over. Got it in good shape to finally go on submission after a year. Was on submission for about 5 months. And yeah, and here we are.
Wow. Yeah. And your agent, so how did you get the agent if it wasn't with this book? Was it with a previous book or was it through writing for television? How did that happen?
Yeah. So basically what happened was I wrote this previous book, but I sent it around and I actually sent it to like publishers that, you know, were taking unagented submissions, right? Because I wanted to get agent interest. And so I actually got interest from a packager for that book. And it led to me emailing agents like, hey, somebody wants to work with me, you know. And the deal for the packager fell through. I say fell through, but it was because my agent basically told me, she was like, I feel like maybe we can do better for you on your own versus going through a packager. There's nothing wrong with going through a packager. I completely understand, you know, why you'd want to do it. But her logic was, I feel like we can maybe debut you stronger instead of going the packager route. And of course, the issue being that the packager just wanted to, you know, do their own thing with the book, right? Whatever
changes they wanted to make, whatever, it was going to be that. I would also technically be, you know, a writer for hire. So if they had any other like thriller ideas, I would also be, you know, on the hook for writing those. Like, and these are not my original ideas, but I will try not to get into the Packager discussion too much. That is a whole thing.
Yeah. And that's something that's important for writers to be aware of as well. And, you know, those 5 months while you were out on submission waiting to hear back, isn't that the worst time? I'm like, so long as I have control over something and I can be writing, I'm happy. But when it's out of my hands and I'm waiting to hear back as to whether some editor is going to pick the book or not, I find that to be hell. How was that experience for you?
So I decided to only check in with my agent once a month about what was going on. I think the most maddening part about being on submission is seeing people who are like, oh, I was on sub for 2 weeks, you know, and I'm good. My book got bought immediately. And you're just like,
oh man, those people.
And you're just waiting to hear back. Like, you know, so I was checking it once a month. And it was also, of course, like just always a downer because every month it was like, yeah, we heard back and like, it's all no, right? No, nobody wants the book until, and this is kind of funny because again, until month 5, and then we finally got publisher interest. And it was very funny because it was 2 different publishers were interested at the exact same time, but it wasn't like, oh, my agent let them know, you know, someone else. It was just, they just independently, both like over one weekend, I think in October, had decided to read the book. And by like that Monday, wanted to have editor calls. Like, that was amazing. So that part was fun. But the 5 months getting up to that was a bit of a struggle. And just having to like, accept that other people's books were getting more traction sooner.
Yeah, I think this is the biggest part of being a writer, is trying not to compare, is trying not to do your head in, going, oh, this is what other writers are getting. They're hearing faster. This is what's happening for them. I think comparison is like the way to hell in the writing industry. And especially even later on, I don't think it ever ends, because when you debut with other people, you're like, oh, well, they got a good review in so-and-so and I didn't, or they're on this show and I'm not. So I really think that, you know, for writers, in terms of my advice in terms of your own happiness is just try not to do that, even though it's very difficult. Because I know if I go onto Twitter and some writer's like, oh, I got a deal and 10 agents or 10 editors were fighting about my book within 2 days, I'm just like, I have to pop a Gaviscon because the stomach acid is high. But yeah, it's, you know, that definitely doesn't help. Sarah, it was wonderful chatting to you. For our listeners, while we were burning, we are linking to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. You can buy it there, support an independent bookstore. Even better, try and find an independent bookstore in Memphis to support. Have you got one that you can give a shout out to, Sarah?
Yes, Novel Memphis, Indie Bookstore Memphis. Please check it out.
Amazing. So try and support the independent bookstore as well. And yeah, read the book. And Sarah, we look forward to having you back next time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.